We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by David McKenzie, the Liberal Democrat candidate for the Scottish parliamentary seat of Glasgow Kelvin. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you, Will, and thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
It's great to have you on. The first question that I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to stand as the Lib Dem candidate for Glasgow Kelvin? What prompted you to get involved in this particular election?
I'm originally from Scotland, originally from a small town called Greenock, which is not too far from Glasgow. Glasgow Kelvin in itself has been sort of a home away from home, if you will, for a number of years. I talked about how I regularly visited Glasgow Kelvin when I was younger. I used to, before a terrible, terrible knee injury, I used to be a runner. And there used to be a stadium in Kelvin called Kelvin Hall, which was an indoor track athletic stadium. It's actually been moved there from now, and it's over the other side of the of Glasgow in the East End, and now at the new arena they built for the Commonwealth Games. But yeah, I used to train the 60 metres in the winter at Kelvin Hall. I actually, weirdly enough, met my partner, my fiancé, in Glasgow Kelvin's constituency boundaries. So we met at a pub called the Old Hairdresser's Bar. And I also used to, I've been very fond of boxing since I was a young man. So my grandfather was a boxer and he introduced me to the sport. And I used to go with my best friend, Stephen. We used to go to a gym called The Grip House, which is on Postle Road, which is, it's actually an MMA gym, but they do boxing as well. And both of us are big fans of combat sports. So we used to go there on a Sunday and train boxing. And when the opportunity arose to stand in Glasgow Kelvin, I jumped at it because I think this is an election where there's a lot for the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Liberal Democrats, to say. And I felt that I was in a position to tell that story. So I thought it was time to get involved.
What do you see as the main priorities for the constituents of Glasgow Kelvin at this election? What do you think is going to motivate them in terms of picking a particular candidate to vote for?
Yeah, so look, I think everybody kind of looks at when you're electing, I always say when you're either electing for the Scottish Parliament or even if you're looking at Westminster, the UK Parliament, people tend to look at two things. They look at the national picture and they look at locally what's important to them. So from a national perspective, I think, and I'll be upfront where I stand on this, and there's no point in hiding away from the constitutional issue, but I believe that now is not the time for that argument. Now is the time to focus on the pandemic and focus on recovery. And I think there's a lot of people, especially when I've been speaking to people on the phones, unfortunately we couldn't door knock for much longer time than people down in England and parts of Wales. But when I've been speaking to people on the phone, they've been saying, look, that now does not seem like the time we want to run this debate again. We want to talk about how do we come out of this pandemic and how do we get the economy back to where it should be. But secondly, from a local perspective, you know, when you're talking to people in Glasgow, there's a number of things that I think really concern them. Now, there's the day-to-day things that, in my opinion, should be easy to fix and aren't getting fixed, things like street lighting and things like potholes. The potholes are atrocious across Glasgow. I would really ask Glasgow City Council what exactly they're doing about it. In fact, the other night there when I was out leafleting, I burst my tyre on one of the potholes and had to wait for the AA to come and pick me up, which was somewhat of an annoyance. But the other thing is I actually was speaking to people from Glasgow University, especially young females the other night there, which was within the Glasgow Kelvin constituency. And because of recurring problems with street lighting, they do not feel safe to walk home at night. And I just don't think that's acceptable for a big city like Glasgow. Now, there's other issues that I think are key and important to talk about. So for the last 10 years, while the SNP have been in power, Glasgow Kelvin's rate of child poverty has increased rapidly. There's now 41% of children in Glasgow Kelvin constituency that are living in poverty. And I don't think that's acceptable. And I would question as to why they've allowed that to happen. And the other point as well is Glasgow Kelvin as a constituency has several of the roads, well, one in particular, which is the most polluted road in the whole of Scotland, which is Hope Street in Glasgow Kelvin, which is within the city centre boundaries. Now, my opposing candidate in the SNP would say that, oh, well, actually, last year it fell below European standards for emissions. But that's because we were in the midst of a pandemic and no one was traveling. So there's got to be questions said and asked about, okay, once we get back to normality, we cannot allow these things to go back to the way they were before. And obviously I'm putting things on the agenda that say, why are these not priority number one? And why are we putting children in poverty and people's health at risk, or we're not actually tackling these local issues?
Now, you mentioned child poverty there, and another issue that has dogged the SNP for its entire time in office has been the issues relating to education. The SNP have continually made promises relating to education that they would improve it, and continually year on year, the education service in Scotland has gotten worse. Why do you think that they have not been able to improve education in Scotland? And what would a Lib Dem majority in the Scottish Parliament do to improve children's education in Scotland?
I think you've got to look at, so there's a couple of factors involved in this, and I think when the First Minister says, judge me on my record on education, then frankly you should kick her out, right? that's the upfront and honest answer. They've absolutely failed over the 14 years that they've been in government to improve education across Scotland. The curriculum changes are not well liked by most teachers. And in fact, when you look at attainment standards, they are going down and not up. Now, I actually was on a hustings the other night with Ivan McKee, who is, I was filling in for another candidate in another part of Glasgow, who was ringing praises about how, oh, actually education's back on the rise. And I just think that you... it's a shoddy answer to say, oh, it's fell, but now it's rising again, so we should be thanked for that. Now, what the Lib Dems intend to do is, first of all, we think you have to have a massive investment in education so that every teacher who wants a job can get a job. And I think we need to reduce class sizes if we're going to deal with the problems of attainment. And secondly, we've also got to make a serious reach out to STEM teachers, people that are coming from especially science backgrounds, to get our young people into STEM jobs, which are going to be crucial when we move forward into things like the green recovery and how we invest in renewable technology, especially engineering. So we are saying that we would start off with a 30k basic wage for people coming out of university that would go into teaching to teach STEM, and then that would increase over a period of years to give them that incentive to go into teaching and help the next generation. Education is something that I think gets a lot of focus, but there's one thing I wanted to say, which was, so my background is I never went to university, so I left school at 16 and went straight into employment. And I was actually quite benefited under the fact that when I was at school, the Scottish Parliament had come into effect when I was 8 years old. And then literally from when I went into high school, it was completely under the Liberal Democrat Labour coalition that was in power at the time at the Holyrood. When I left school, that's when the SNP just came into power. Now, I was benefited from a Scottish Government programme that got me into employment with a company called Hewlett-Packard, which some people might know, which is a major technology firm. And through that investment, I went on to build a career within the technology industry that now leads me to where I am now, where I'm a software consultant. Most of the people I work with on a daily basis have degrees. I don't. That's not to say education's a bad thing, but I think we've also got to look at, okay, for people who might not be able to get to that attainment level, what are we doing to help them next? And I think you've also got to look at the fact that the SNP massively cut college places to pay for free university tuition. And as we all know, college is the route for people who come out of impoverished backgrounds and also people who didn't manage to attain the levels to go to university to make that next leap towards further education. So systematically what they've done is they've carved out a route to future employment and a route to a future life embedment by taking those college places away. And I just think that's a travesty.
Now, on the point of education, the Scottish Lib Dems manifesto promises to ensure that every qualified teacher will, you know, remain in teaching. Is that going to cost any extra amount than is already going into the education budget, or would it simply be ensuring that teachers aren't faced with the same kind of challenges that they are with class sizes? What would entail relating to that?
Yeah, so look, I think we do have to make further investment in the education budget. I mean, I don't think there's any way around that. But, you know, if you look at the costings for the manifesto, I think it's one of the best costed manifestos across all the parties. In terms of the, you know, I think what we need to do is we need to make sure that we're reducing those class sizes down. Now, one thing that I think is quite interesting that might sort of change the dynamic is obviously getting more teachers into employment. But we've also talked about we want to follow the Nordic model of education, which means that younger children wouldn't actually start formal education until the age of 7. Now, that obviously would mean that before the age of 7, they'd mostly be learning through play to learn, nursery type settings. That's what they do in the Nordic countries. They have much higher attainment levels than we do. And I think if you look at actually taking that 2-year gap out, there's a huge amount of savings that would then pay for more teachers at the other end of the spectrum. And I think it's through dynamic changes like this that are going to help pay for that process.
What impact do you think online learning, which of course a lot of children have been going through because of the pandemic, will have on the future of education? Do you think there will be more emphasis on using online resources and potentially more teaching online going into the future?
I think it's an interesting question. I before all this happened, I used to do some, well, I say used to do, I still do, some online training courses with platforms like Udemy and also, God, I can't remember the name of the other one, I do apologise, but I did a course with Harvard Law School that was on deliberations for social change and how to use sort of groups like juries to make decisions, which all comes back to things like citizens' assemblies, which I think are hugely important. I tend to find that I feel I learn much better in settings like that that use online tuition, and you can pick and choose when to come back to it. At school, I probably didn't have the best attention span. There are distractions that come. So I think we do need to look. A lot more children these days are hugely technology savvy, and probably the next generation that comes after that are going to be even more so. So I think there is an opportunity to look at collaboration and how you take classrooms and online learning and mix them together so that future generations can learn. I also think, like, when I was at school, you used to take homework home, write it in a jotter, and then hand it in to the teacher. You know, maybe there's a way to look at, could you do your homework online and then, you know, simply send it to the teacher to mark that evening. These are all things that I think need to be discussed when we come out of this pandemic and how much people want to change. It's interesting you should say that, because I think what's quite interesting is a lot of businesses are looking at not a return to normality, but there's not really been much discussion about anything else beyond businesses and not going back to sort of 5 days in the office type settings.
Now, on the subject of businesses, in the manifesto, there is a commitment for 2,000 paid graduate internships with small businesses. What impact do you think that would have on local economies, local businesses, and how much would it cost?
So, I mean, first of all, there's the interesting aspect about this. I think it would absolutely benefit people, because a lot of graduates are coming out now and they can't find work. So if you make a strategic investment in getting those people into work, it not only benefits the graduate and getting work experience, it also benefits a lot of these small to medium enterprises in getting somebody that's just come out of university, has a lot of knowledge, maybe has some new ways of working that could be beneficial to the business to help it grow as well. But beyond that, what we're also talking about is when we come out of the pandemic, especially for things like the hospitality sector, is looking at cutting business tax rates so that they can recover faster and not put the burden of this onto the people who've had to be closed for the majority of the time that we've asked, you know, business people and the general public to you know, stick with us to get through this pandemic. And I think that's important. I think when you look at how it's funded, it's easy to take, when somebody comes out of a university and they're looking for work, obviously they're going to have to take a level of benefits while they do job seeking. So simply, if you just shift the cost from job seeking into actually funding these people to go into, which I think is also quite interesting when we talk about things like, people have asked me before, how are you going to fund a UBI? Well, actually, if you look at the amount of administration costs, et cetera, that go into working out who should get benefits and where and doing all the testing and everything, you could save a lot of money by reducing that down by just giving everybody a universal basic income. So I think all these things about come out, you're a graduate, we put funding towards putting you into work, we take it out of things like job seekers allowance, you know, that it'll be easy to cost that.
In terms of UBI, you mentioned there, obviously, cheaper in terms of giving it rather than in terms of benefits. Would there be a cutoff point in terms of people who earn a certain amount of income? Because one of the things that opponents of UBI said, well, what's the point in giving, say, somebody who's earning 500 grand a year or whatever, someone at the height of the economy and monetary attainment, what's the point of giving them a universal basic income? So would there be certain people who would be priced out because of the income that they're already getting from employment?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. And what I would first of all say is that we are still going through the policy for how a UBI would be funded and how it would work. So I don't want to make any assertions that this is, you know, lived in policy yet, because obviously with a UBI, it would fundamentally have to come from the Westminster government. That power's not devolved yet. So we would need to work out exactly what scale we'd be doing this on. But I think there's opportunities to do pilots. Now, it's interesting, though. I've had some conversations with Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, who is an MP for the Liberal Party in Canada. And they're obviously going through pilots of universal basic income at the moment. Now, there are people that do say, well, why would you give money to people who might be millionaires, billionaires, or quite wealthy and in the top, you know, sort of 1-2% of the country? I think that's something that needs to be looked at. But obviously, the term universal basic income would tend to mean that it's across the board and it's not means tested. What's interesting, though, is so as we come out of this pandemic, we've gone through a GDP yo-yo effect where, you know, the GDP fell in the first lockdown, then it slightly rose again, and then it massively dropped again in the second lockdown. And in fact, you know, if we do perhaps go into, we've gone into a third lockdown, if we do perhaps go into a fourth, and again, we might see a major dip. The interesting thing about what Canada are looking at, they call it economic guardrails, which is how do we get the economy back onto a level footing once we come out of, you know, structural lockdowns. And they've said, actually, piloting a UBI could be very effective because, especially for people in low-income households, if you give them money, they are guaranteed to spend it. So you push that money back into the economy and it's cyclical. And what that means is obviously more money being spent, more people get employed because the money's been spent. And obviously then it goes back into tax revenues and then it's a cyclical economical effect. So I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about how would it benefit people who were on low income or in poverty at the moment, and how that would help them in their life. But we also need to look at the levels. What would we actually be putting in people's pockets to be able to spend? I'm not too sure, if I'm honest, about the means tested aspect about what about people who make X, Y, and Z. But, you know, these are all things that have to be worked out before the policy is put in place.
In terms of investment to get the economy going again, there's about 100 Conservative MPs at Westminster who have suggested that everyone between the ages of 18 and 24 is given £500 as a means of restoring the high street and getting the economy moving again. Would this be something that you think, if it was passed in Westminster, that something that you would like to see happen in Scotland?
I mean, it's another interesting question. You've obviously seen when they did something similar in America, where they gave everybody a check from the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, to actually go out and spend, and it did have quite a boosting effect on the economy. So, look, with these things, I always defer to what economists think and if they think it would be beneficial. I'm not opposed to it. I'd probably just need to see the workings on how it would be deployed. And, you know, I always tend to think, well, what are the Tories proposing? Because it's sometimes not always what I would suggest to do. So, but yeah, look, I think there is a case to be made about can we give people some money to, you know, maybe in something that's targeted that would be particularly for spend on high streets, etc., that could help get them back, because a lot of high streets have really suffered. And I know my mum and dad still live in Greenock, and the high street in Greenock is, to be frank, it's mostly bedding shops and charity shops, and any sort of linchpin businesses that they had there have really suffered as a result of this. And in fact, some of them have pulled out during this pandemic. And in fact, some businesses have obviously liquidated. In little towns like Greenock, where I'm from, you know, it's the high street that's the focal point, and it really hurts a local area when we lose these services. And the same thing can be said for Glasgow Kelvin. I mean, I know, I was the other day there talking to the Federation of Small Businesses, and we were talking about encouraging people to go out and spend and get back into shops, etc. And I was encouraging people to go down, and something I'd visited in the past was my local comic book store, City Centre Comics. Now, back in the day, I used to be a huge avid comic book reader. I can't say I do much of it now, probably because My fiance doesn't let me have that amount of time to read comics, but you know, it's little independent businesses like this that are really going to need support and are really going to need backing. And if we lose them, you might never get those services back.
We're going to take a short break now to listen to a trailer for the Politics of Sound podcast's May episode. When we get back, I'll be talking to David about working with the banking sector, railways and renewable energy, Brexit, and what he's most looking forward to being able to do once coronavirus has been ended and things are back to normal. Back with you in a moment.
May is just around the corner, and that means the new edition of the Politics of Sound podcast. That's the show on which politicians and other political figures reveal their all-time three favourite albums. My guest this month is the latest YouTube sensation, Max Fosh, whose comedy videos have commanded huge audiences. But how serious is his bid to be the next London mayor? And what would be his first thought if he actually won?
You might have to bleep this one out, but my first thought is shit.
So that's the Politics of Sound podcast, out on the 1st of May with me, Ian Carnegie, and my guest, Max Fosh. I hope you enjoy it.
To what extent do you think in helping small businesses, as you mentioned both in Greenock and Glasgow, Kelvin, to what extent do you think that a government, whether it be the Scottish Parliament or the Westminster Parliament, would have to work with banks and the banking sector in order that perhaps they're not as fastidious in asking for return of loans from businesses, perhaps for a certain period? Do you think that that is something that would have to be done? How do you think the governments could work with the banks to make things easier for smaller businesses?
Yeah, look, I think there's a case to be made. The banking sector, you know, to be clear, my thoughts on this, and this is my thoughts, you know, post-2008, you know, the government in the United Kingdom absolutely majorly helped the banking sector to survive what was a catastrophic event, which could have seen a number of those banking institutions go under. And I think there's then a case to be made that if we are truly all in this together in this pandemic, then we band together and we look at how you can maybe give people. I mean, we've given homeowners mortgage holidays, and I think there's maybe opportunities to save for, you know, businesses. I've heard some horrible, horrible stories about people who had just set up their own independent business just before the pandemic hit, and they've had to close them down because they had no income they could go for. So I think, you know, there's an opportunity to talk that through, and I think it would be benefited if it was something that was discussed a UK-wide perspective as opposed to maybe some nations deciding to go off and do their own thing.
In terms of economic impact, obviously we've discussed coronavirus, but Brexit has also had an economic impact as well. How do you feel, you know, a couple of years on from leaving the European, the impact has been on Scotland? Do you think that there should be a movement at some point in the relative near future for the UK or just Scotland for rejoining the European Union?
Well, let's take that in a couple of steps first of all. So look, I'm a proud European, and I advocated madly and almost exerted myself too much in the Remain cause. I actually, at the time I was living in Reading in England, so I've lived across parts of the UK, and at the time I was living in Reading when I worked for Oracle in the technology sector. And so I campaigned in Reading for Remain. I campaigned in London when I was at the office in London in the evenings there. I campaigned in Scotland when I came home to visit my mum and dad. And in some ways that kind of gave me this false sense of security, because Reading was heavily Remain, London was heavily Remain. And then when I was at home in Scotland, it was heavily Remain. My partner, Grace, she is from the East Midlands. And so when we went to visit her parents in Derbyshire, I did some campaigning there, and I was like, oh, okay, right. every door I'm knocking here is not exactly very positive about the EU. I am also passionate about Scotland remaining a member of the United Kingdom. Now, I would caveat that with saying, and I was on a hustings the other night there, and the Tories pulled me up for this, and I don't think they fully understood what I was saying. As I said, I'm not afraid of the term unionist, but I consider myself a federalist. But I appreciate that a federal country is part of a union. I just don't think people understand the difference. And the Tories jumped on it and said, oh, you know, they don't support the union, which is just not the case. But I'm a federalist, so I believe in a new constitutional settlement for, you know, all the nations that make up the United Kingdom. In terms of what that means for the future, look, obviously from my perspective, I ultimately would like to see the United Kingdom rejoin the European Union. I don't think the case can be made right now for that to happen. But I think there's a roadmap to rejoining that's maybe in the medium to long-term future. And I think when you look at the majority of people who voted Remain and the young demographic, I think there will eventually come a time that that will happen. My opinion is, though, that the United Kingdom as a whole has a better chance of rejoining the European Union than an independent Scotland does, because I think there's a lot of factors that the SNP are just simply not being honest about that would affect Scotland's chances of joining the European Union. Interestingly enough, Alex Salmond's ALBA party announced that they do not think an independent Scotland should rejoin the EU because of the asks that they would have to do to get there. For instance, like taking the euro as a currency. But first of all, you'd have to set up your own independent currency, and it'd have to run in a decent manner, because they don't want to get people in that are going to do what happened with Greece, you know, where they have to bail them out. They want strong countries that can come into the European Union with, you know, strong with a strong currency, but then ultimately they would want you to take the euro as part of rejoining. And I think secondly as well, you know, they keep on dismissing the fact that Spain is going to have a major problem with an independent Scotland rejoining the European Union. And I can tell you right now, from colleagues that I work with in Spain, they do not want an independent Scotland in the European Union, because they know what that would mean for Spain, and especially the autonomous region of Catalan. And I think there's also, you know, there's other parts of the European Union that would be very scared about that. You know, you look at Belgium, there's some concerns about the Flemish, you know, community there as well. So I think they need to be a bit more honest about that roadmap. And they also need to be honest about the number of years it would take. So not only do you have to decouple yourself from the United Kingdom, which if Brexit has shown us anything, it's not an easy process. And we've got many hundreds of years more tied together as a member of the United Kingdom than, you know, 40 odd years of membership of the European Union. But in terms of how it's affected Scotland's economy, like I'm not going to sit here and lie that Brexit's not had a bad effect. Obviously, you know, our fishermen have been massively impacted. A lot of our farmers have been massively impacted as a result of coming out of the common agricultural policy. And I think, you know, ultimately a lot of businesses will suffer. The whisky industry took a little bit of an impact as well. But also it took a bit of an impact because of tariffs that were put on from America for a period of time when that madman was in the office. it's not been easy, and it would not have been what I'd chosen to do. But I think obviously I have to respect that that's the decision that we've come to. I had a conversation with Gavin Esler. If you know Gavin Esler, who used to present BBC Newsnight the other night, and he's wrote a book phrased in a manner that's obviously eye-catching, How Britain Ends and the Rise of Four Nations. But in that book, he talks about federalism. And the other thing that we need to consider as a part of Brexit, and something that I'm very passionate about just because of my background. So my family, my great-grandfather's originally from Northern Ireland. So we have sort of strong ties to Northern Ireland. It's how Brexit's massively impacted Northern Ireland. And there's also people in Glasgow that come from Irish community backgrounds have serious concerns about what's happening in the Irish Sea and how that might affect Northern Ireland. And also people who come from the Republic of Ireland who live in Glasgow that are very, very concerned about what this means for their status as a resident. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of issues that we need to overcome, but I think it's still got a number of years before we get back to any stability.
I'd just like to turn back to the manifesto for a moment, because in the manifesto, there is a commitment to reopening railway lines, moving away from fossil fuels used on the networks, coal, for example, to help with trains going up and down the lines. In terms of reopening railway lines, what impact do you think that that would have in terms of the economy, and how much do you think it would cost in terms of reopening railway lines as opposed to opening and constructing new railway lines.
Yeah, look, I think there is obviously an opportunity to do a major upgrade of Scotland's railway network, but I think we also need to look at what the economic impact would be of not getting more people onto public transport. And when I talked at the start about the levels of pollution that are in places like Glasgow, and obviously we're massively impacted by the fact that people who travel into Glasgow predominantly sit on what's called the Kingston Bridge, which is obviously majorly backlogged all the time, which leads to pollution problems in the city centre. And in fact, we're trying to encourage more people to get on public transport. The problem with public transport in Scotland is obviously the network has not been upgraded. The trains are specifically very old on a lot of the lines that come into Glasgow. If you look at, I hate to go back to it. I'm obviously standing in Glasgow, but if you look at, for instance, Greenock, where my mum and dad live, the trains that run on the Inverclyde line are ancient. They're like old models, and they're not very energy efficient. So I think there is a really good case to be made there. In terms of how it would actually be funded, there was a £50 million programme for public transport that's been delayed until 2025, and we're calling for that to be brought forward to assist in getting more people onto public transport and upgrading the network. But we've talked about basically getting together a panel to look at sustained long-term investment into the public transport network across the whole of Scotland. So not just the railways, but also how we encourage more people onto buses, and also onto things like active travel. So, cycling, walking, and how we make, investments into those. Getting things like more cycle lanes in Glasgow will be beneficial for getting people. But we've also talked about this idea of changing planning structures so you can get things like 20-minute neighbourhoods. Mm-hmm. So you can get to the doctors, to your supermarket, to local businesses within a 20-minute walk, as opposed to having to drive to them. Now, obviously, that's a major ambition for towns and cities. A bit more difficult for rural areas, I appreciate, because there's people, who live on farms, on hills in the middle of nowhere, and obviously they will have to still be able to get in a car and drive. But I think what we've announced is we'll undertake a major spending review, and then we'll look at the best ways to achieve a significant investment on rail and bus infrastructure. One of the things I wanted to just briefly touch on was that when I mentioned about Hope Street in Glasgow, which is the most polluted street in the whole of Scotland, what I found really quite baffling and a bit shocking was the Scottish Government made a strategic investment to introduce hydrogen buses in Dundee and Aberdeen. And that was jointly funded by it's a European programme for hydrogen transport. They bought those buses from Wrightbus in Northern Ireland, and they have now been instituted in Aberdeen and Dundee. For the life of me, I can't understand why you wouldn't have done that in the most polluted place in Scotland. And I think the fact that we're still talking about it might be a few years before we get hydrogen buses into Glasgow city centre. I'm just not willing to wait. Let's get it done now. Let's put the strategic funding needed towards that. One of my people that I'm competing against in the seat, Patrick Harvey, doesn't think we should invest in hydrogen technology. He thinks we should just get everybody on bikes. I think I'm a bit more pragmatic in the fact that I don't think you're ever going to get everybody on bikes away from cars and buses. Let's try and make them as green as possible. I think there's a really good opportunity to discuss about how we get people out of diesel and petrol cars and into things like electric vehicles and hydrogen vehicles. And maybe that's a case of looking at, do we want to institute some sort of policy in Glasgow city centre for low emissions vehicles as well. So, I think that's the route we need to go down, but that's how we would fund this. I think we need to have a panel and a strategic review about how we spend on public transport.
We're coming to the end of the podcast, David. It's been great to have you on, and I have one final question. We've discussed coronavirus a great deal during this podcast, as you mentioned. We're beginning to ease a little bit in terms of restrictions, but there are obviously still a great deal of issues in terms of people getting about and acting as they would normally. So what one thing are you most looking forward to being able to do when coronavirus is finally a thing of the past?
Do you know, that's a good question, and I think coronavirus has been difficult. I mean, I've worked entirely through this whole pandemic, mostly from home. Typically, I would have been my business and my work is based in London, so I would have been in London quite a lot, and I haven't now been in London for way over a year now, and I haven't. Typically, I would travel quite a lot of places with my work. Before the day that we announced the lockdown, I was in Belfast visiting a customer, and I had to fly back to the mainland. I was a bit worried about how that was going to go down. And I think it's just weird. It's changed my whole way of working. I mean, I've talked in a few hustings about I've done a lot of traveling to San Francisco because I've done a lot of work in Silicon Valley. It's been so long since I've done that. But I think the most important thing to me is seeing my family. I've not been able to see a lot of my family members in a real setting for quite a while. My grandfather passed away from COVID back in February, which was not the nicest of things. And he was in a care home. So I never actually got to see him before he died. And I've not really been able to see my grandmother since that happened, up beyond attending the funeral. So that's been difficult. And I would really like to get back to that level of being able to visit my family properly. So I think that's the most important thing to me. But I think there's also, I don't want to be one of the people that says, like, I'm dying to go to the pub. But, but it would be nice to see my friends and stuff like that and go and have a drink. But in the immediacy, I've got an election to get through and deal with that. So, just looking forward to that. And how about yourself? Have you got things you're looking forward to doing?
Well, yes, I would probably seeing family like yourself, getting out more. It seems ages since we've been able to go anywhere, really. So yeah, I mean, those would be the kind of things that would be the top of my priority list.
Yeah. No, I hope everybody who's listening, has managed to get through this in as well a manner as possible. And I hope everybody's keeping mentally as fit as possible, because I know these are difficult times. And, hopefully things like this podcast can help people get through what's been a very difficult year or a year and a half in reality. Weirdly enough, I was going to say just before we finish up, I was in Italy the week before they instituted lockdown for coronavirus. God. And when I was at, I don't know, God, I'm so thankful as well, because I'd went to the AC Milan Inter Milan derby and I was traveling on the subway, and I just thought, I don't know how I managed to avoid that. Like as soon as I got back and I heard how bad it was, I thought, better go and get tested. But I hadn't had it. So it's that seems like such a long time ago now. And I just really hope a lot of people out there are managing to get through on a daily basis, because it's been difficult. It's been a difficult year and a half.
I agree with you completely. David, if people want to find out more about your campaign, where should they go to find out more about your campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on Twitter. So I am at David X McKenzie. McKenzie spelled M-C-K, not M-A-C-K. I've been announced on a lot of things as M-A-C-K, and I try not to be pernickety about it, but it's but that's the way it's spelled. I got asked recently I got interviewed for another podcast, and they said, does the X mean anything? Is it your middle name? And I said, well, no. I said, I couldn't take David McKenzie. And I said, when I was a little boy, I really wanted my middle name to be Xander, but that didn't happen. So in some ways that fills in for it. And then obviously I'm on Facebook. You can find me at David McKenzie for Glasgow Kelvin, or I think if you just type in facebook.com/DavidLibDem, it comes up. And yeah, those are the social channels I'm on. I'm not going to lie, I'm not a big Instagram person. I've never used it, so I don't have an Instagram. Because somebody asked me that the other day there, can I find you on Instagram? And I said, no, I'm afraid you can't. So feel free to reach out to me on those platforms, and be always happy to connect to people who are interested in the world of politics.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Will. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.